This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in for Michael Monks. We start the Friday news review with Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like we're talking a lot about the city of Cincinnati and the Cincinnati Public School Board and the tax abatement. Before we talk about where we're at right now, set the scene of why we're discussing this abatement issue right now.
So from 1999 until December 31st, there was an agreement between the city and the public schools where the city could basically offer unlimited abatements to developers at a certain level and not have to come to the school board for approval. Since that agreement has expired, the city is kind of bound by state law, which has a lesser amount of abatements that it can offer developers, and if they want more than that, they have to go to the school board, which is kind of an additional layer of bureaucracy and something that really the school board isn't interested in having to do, and developers certainly aren't interested in having to go to two different public bodies to really get incentives to build or rehabilitate existing buildings.
And this agreement, this 1999 agreement, expired on New Year's Eve. Last week, the mayor seemed to indicate that he had an agreement on a new abatement plan that had the support of five council members. And then there was a meeting this week at Cincinnati City Hall where it became pretty apparent that there were not five council members who were willing to support that proposal that Mayor Cranley announced.
Right, right. So basically, Mayor Cranley's agreement with the Cincinnati Public School Board was to basically require developers to pay 33% of the total millage on improvements to buildings that people are rehabilitating or building. The old level was 25% or 27%, depending on where it was and the conditions. So this was an increase. The school board had previously received $5 million a year from the city to supplement that 25 or 27% payment. The city is no longer interested in doing that, and so the level was increased to 33%. The mayor's agreement was for 10 years. When the Cincinnati City Council met on Tuesday to consider these issues and talk about them, it kind of became apparent that they weren't sure that 33% was the right level, and this has kind of been the dispute throughout this. What is the fair make-whole percentage for the school district? In other words, they want to receive the amount of property taxes they would get on these new construction or rehabilitated buildings as if there was no abatement whatsoever, right? And so the city and the school district for, really about a year have been arguing over the right level. The city solicitor's office actually says it's about 5%. And the school board says the city's numbers are completely wrong and fail to really consider the situation. So this has been an ongoing argument, and so council said, well, wait a minute, we need to talk about this more. But as the week has gone on, the school board proposed 33% for 5 years instead of 10 years, and so now that the council is there's a motion circulating amongst council members. Three of them have signed it so far. It looks like P.G. Sittenfeld and David Mann, according to the motion that I've seen. And I can't make out the third signature.
I think it's Greg Landsman.
Probably Greg Landsman. That would make sense. And so that's going around, and we'll see if they get five on that. It sounds like it's a compromise everybody would sign on to if they can get the fourth and fifth votes on council.
Did you get the sense that when the part of the reason for the meeting on Tuesday to discuss this was for the school board's treasurer, the school district treasurer, to come and explain the district's math for the reason that it believes 33% is the right number? It seemed like for a lot of council members that explanation or the math, they said the math was pretty simple, but was the presentation maybe too simple that it really didn't go into enough depth of why 33% was the right number?
I know that was kind of an issue. The reason, if we want to get in the weeds to it, the short version of it is basically the school district has fixed sum levies and fixed rate levies. So fixed sum levy is basically I put a levy out for property tax and I need to collect $1 million from all of the property owners of the city. And so I'll collect that $1 million regardless of who is actually paying the tax. And then there's a fixed rate levy where I set the rate, let's say I set a rate at 1 mil, and everybody is assessed at property tax with the exception of people who have abatements. And so the school district is basically saying, well, the amount of your property tax bill that is a fixed sum levy for us is one-third. And so that's the number we believe that we should get from developers when their taxes are abated. And that's basically how they came up with the math. The city says, well, no, wait a minute. There's a number of other factors that go in here, including the state school funding formula. The city claims that the district benefits when the school district or when the city abates property taxes for developers, that it benefits on the back end through the school funding formula. The school district vehemently disputes that. And they basically say, well, look, we are the experts. We deal with the school funding formula all day, every year. And so we know what we're talking about. The city is wrong about this. And so that's kind of, you know, and I think that the school district treasurer was caught a little off guard, and I don't think she was expecting to have kind of a rebuttal from the school district or from the city attorney's, you know, staff. And she basically, you know, I mean, she tried to rebut it, but it, you know, I think for some council members it might have not been clear, or they weren't prepared to have a debate about it, and that's kind of what it turned into.
What will this mean for developers? I think that from what I'm hearing, they want a longer term. Are they going to be satisfied with a shorter 5-year term?
Their initial position was that I think they wanted a decade at least, and the former agreement was 2 decades. Developers want certainty. They want to know what their costs are going to be, and so the longer the term, the better. I know that they have concerns about the 33%. Because on top of that, the city has its own program that requires them to pay either 15% into the streetcar fund if you're in downtown or over the Rhine doing a project, or 15% into a neighborhood and affordable housing fund if you're outside of those, and actually Pendleton's in there too, outside of Pendleton, downtown, and over the Rhine. So they're concerned about the amount of their abatements being reduced. Right now they can max out at about a 60% abatement. This agreement would bring that at about 48% agreement, assuming they keep the, you know, the city program itself.
But to recap, the school board seems to have passed a resolution for supporting 33% for 5 years with annual audits, and it sounds like some council members are jumping on that as well.
Right. It sounds like they're willing to do the annual or the 5-year agreement at 33%. The important factor there is the audit, though. That'll give them some third-party information, which the city has been clamoring for, to get an analysis that's not from the city and not from the school board, and they think that's really, really important. I suspect that'll be in the final agreement.
Before we completely run out of our time here, let's talk about something that happened last weekend. You were there when the Hamilton County Democratic Party met to do endorsements in some local races, and probably the one that got the biggest headline was that the party decided not to endorse incumbent Democratic Sheriff Jim Neal and instead issued an endorsement for his opponent, Charmaine McGuffey. How surprised were you by that?
I was a little surprised. We had heard going in that that Charmaine McGuffey might have the votes. McGuffey was the former superintendent of the jail there, or the person in charge of the jail, and of course Sheriff Neal fired her when she refused to accept the demotion. So she is ending up running against him in the Democratic primary. You know, the Democrats were very, very specific about why this occurred. There was a nominating committee that interviewed Jim Neal, and the way the Democrats, you know, this is really important for listeners to understand their process. The Democrats start from a point of, if we have an incumbent office holder, chances are we ought to endorse our incumbent because they have, you know, been loyal to the party, and, you know, in Jim Neal's case, he's raised money. He's won clear victories in 2008, 2012. So the party stated up front that they viewed that as, you know, pretty good. You know, they want to endorse their incumbents whenever possible. But when he went into the interview, he basically flunked it, which was what the nominating committee chair, Brett Bourne, told the overall executive committee, which voted on these endorsements last Saturday. And the things that she cited were, you know, he was effusive in his praise of Butler County Sheriff Richard Jones, who is kind of known nationally for a very significant opposition to illegal immigration and participating in kind of trying to cooperate with the federal government on rounding up those folks and seeing them deported. And so that's kind of, it's against the Democratic Party's principles. So when he praised Sheriff Jones, that was kind of a red flag for the committee. And there were some other issues. They felt that he did not acknowledge racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And they felt that was an issue, too, because that's a big topic of reform nationwide. At that point, they said, we got to look at other candidates. And they looked at McGuffey, and that's who they endorsed.
Just real quick before we run out of time here completely, Sheriff Neal says McGuffey can't win in November because local law enforcement won't support her. Similarly, Jason Williams, who's a columnist with the Cincinnati Enquirer, seemed to agree with that. You said that you had a different take on that.
Oh, I don't know. We'll see. The thing about the election in Hamilton County lately has been it's been trending blue, and the party puts a big emphasis on its sample ballot and showing people who the Democratic endorsed candidate is, and that really paid dividends in 2018, bringing a bunch of people who, the Democratic Party has never been good at electing judges, and they managed to elect quite a few. And so, we'll see. Law enforcement, their endorsements carry a great weight in this region, and I think they will continue to. But I would not count out the party. I think it's going to be a close race no matter who the Democrats nominate.
Chris Wetterich is a reporter and columnist with the Cincinnati Business Courier. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
Coming up, a constitutional amendment could be on the Ohio ballot in November to expand and solidify voter rights. And a sixth grader takes on Cincinnati City Hall. We have those stories and much more just ahead. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Michael Monks. If you have a comment on anything we're talking about today, 513-419-7100. And you can also email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. We continue the Friday News Review with Ohio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Hello, Andy.
Hey, Jay. How's it going?
Not bad. How are you today?
Good.
Let's start with House Bill 6, and that had some news this week.
Yeah.
For the last maybe year or so. It's commonly known as the bailout for Ohio's nuclear power plants. Before we talk about what happened this week, what tell us about House Bill 6. What did it do, or what would it do?
Oh, boy. Okay. Like you said, it was kind of this long saga. So for years and years now here at the State House, there have been sort of these lingering questions about how the state wants to deal with its energy policy, how it wants to take on renewable energy, energy efficiency, coal, and nuclear. So for a couple of years now, we've known the writing was on the wall that the two nuclear plants, which are up in the northern part of Ohio, were not doing well economically. They were having a hard time competing with all the other energy sources. So for years, First Energy Solutions, which runs the plants, they were looking at for subsidies. This is just a culmination of years and years of talking about this, and it all culminated into HB 6 last year, which had a strong endorsement from Republican House Speaker Larry Householder. Now, this bill was a pretty comprehensive package, meaning it would have increased people's electric bills, their monthly electric bills, in order to subsidize nuclear plants and basically keep them open. Electric bills would have also seen an increase in their bills to subsidize struggling coal plants. And the state rolled back its standards for helping prop up renewable energy, and it eliminated its energy efficiency package. So it took on a couple of different things. Ultimately, everybody would have seen an increase in their electric bills to subsidize coal and nuclear, but they would have seen a decrease in the charges to help renewable and energy efficiency. That's what it is in a nutshell. Now, this was a big blockbuster deal that was seen as a bailout for corporations. So a group wanted to put a referendum of HB 6 on this year's ballot. As a lot of people probably know, there were a lot of signature gathers around Ohio trying to gather signatures to be able to put that referendum on the ballot. There is also a multi-million dollar backed opposition trying to block people from being able to gather signatures. There were mailers, there were ads. It's just big opposition campaign. This all culminated with a court case where the group that wanted to put the referendum on the ballot, they were not able to collect the signatures they needed. So they went to the court for more help, saying that they faced an uphill battle and faced constitutional questions. In the end, the courts basically decided against that case. There was an appeal that was up in the air. The referendum group saying, "Hey, you know, this law is already in place. We've faced so much opposition, so much money is being spent against us. This is an insurmountable hill to climb." So they've decided this week to drop out of the case.
So is that truly the end of it, or is this just merely a pause until they maybe figure out a new path?
So HB 6 and everything that I talked about, those increase in charges here and decrease in charges there, all those things are now in the works. HB 6 is now effectively law. Most of those changes do not go into effect, meaning electric bills will not see changes until the beginning of 2021. So there is some wiggle room if a group really wanted to try to challenge the law in some other way. As far as a referendum is concerned, it seems like no, that's not going to happen, because the laws of a referendum mean that you need to get something in the works within 90 days of the bill becoming law, and that time window has now closed.
Well, we'll watch if you have any further reporting on that. Something else you reported on this week, that there could be a voting-related constitutional amendment on the November ballot. Who's pursuing that, and what would it do?
So as of right now, it's a group known as Ohioans for Fair and Secure Elections, and they're sort of putting themselves out there as what they're calling a broad-based coalition of advocates. Right now, we know that the main group behind it is the ACLU of Ohio. And what they're really fighting to do here is to put in the Ohio Constitution, or to guarantee in the Ohio Constitution, a list of things that they say will expand voter rights. So some of the things that the proposed constitutional amendment would do is ensure that military members and people living overseas who are still citizens of Ohio ensure that they would still get their ballots in a timely manner. It would also create an automatic registration program through the BMV. This is known as the automatic or the optional opt-out. So basically, everybody who goes to the BMV, they are automatically registered to vote unless they want to opt out of it. A lot of voting advocates have said that this is a really great program to help keep people registered and to keep them in the books and in the polls. This would also allow citizens to register at a polling location and vote on the same day. This is something that has been in question for a while. There are other states that have tried to do this, and again, advocates say that, well, you know, let's say election day comes around and you want to vote and then you find out that you're not actually registered. Well, why not just register the day of? And then lastly, it would guarantee 28 days of early voting. So right now in Ohio, a citizen can vote up to 28 days before the actual election day. And as I'm sure everyone knows, that there's now early in-person voting at their local county board of election. There's also mail-in ballots and absentee ballots that they could send in. That's something that's already in place here, but it's something that's authorized by election officials, by the Secretary of State. What this would do is put it into statute to make it so that it is in the Ohio Constitution. And the reason they want to do something like that is because in the past, the Ohio actually had a longer period of early voting. Back in 2014, Ohioans could have voted 35 days before election, but that was then shortened to 28 days. So the gist of this whole thing is that there are some things that are already in play here in Ohio. The constitutional amendment would create some new voting rights as well. But with all of those things that are in the measure, it would solidify it in the Ohio Constitution rather than just sort of leaving it up to whatever person is in charge in whatever year.
Now, if they want to be successful and have this on the ballot in November, they have quite a bit of work to do, correct?
Yeah, so with a constitutional amendment, again, it's another long hill to climb because it would be a permanent change to the Constitution. So in order to put this issue on the ballot, the group needs to collect 10% of enough signatures to equal 10% of the last gubernatorial election. So in this case, they need to collect around the state nearly 443,000 valid signatures. And, you know, people who are familiar with petition gathering and petition drives, you need to basically, I don't know, even double that to make sure that you are getting actual valid signatures. So people who are already registered in Ohio. So again, they need 443,000 valid signatures before July, but basically by the start of July, in order to get on the November ballot.
Do we know yet? Has there been anyone come out opposing this proposed change?
I haven't heard of any groups to do that yet. Sometimes when you hear about these ballot initiatives early on in the process, groups will sort of let the ballot initiative kind of make their claim for a little bit first, and then you start to see other interests get involved. What we have seen is that this is very similar to a proposition that was on the ballot in Michigan in 2018. It did not face a huge amount of opponents. In fact, there was a broad-based coalition of support led by the ACLU. There were other progressive groups involved. Labor unions got involved. That measure in Michigan in 2018 passed with 66% of the vote. So basically an overwhelming majority of the people in Michigan put these laws in their books.
So clearly something else you'll be following throughout this year, at least through July. We know that.
Yep.
Andy Chow from the Ohio State House News Bureau, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Joining me now in the studio is WCPO transportation reporter Pat LaFleur with a unique story. Welcome, Pat.
Hey, thanks, Jay.
Before we tell the story, this involves a student in the Mount Washington area who was trying to get a sidewalk built in her neighborhood. Her name is Madeline Gerker, and she was actually on Cincinnati Edition to discuss her concerns about walking to school without a sidewalk. And she told us she wrote a letter to Mayor John Cranley, and here she is explaining it.
I was explaining how dangerous it is to walk to school, and we have to be constantly dodging cars, especially if we walk back from school, then we will during rush hour, then a bunch of cars just go down our street as a shortcut.
Madeline Gerker telling us about her efforts to get a sidewalk in her neighborhood so she could walk to school. I recall, did she speak during the public comment portion of the council meeting and basically read her letter or expressed the same concerns that she had in her letter?
That's right. So this was back in the spring of 2018 when she sent this letter in. And since then, she's not only addressed city council, but she's addressed the Mount Washington Community Council and the Cincinnati School Board. So she's really, throughout the course of this crusade of hers, she's really run the gamut as far as all of the elected officials she could pester about this.
And her effort worked, I believe. Has it been quite a year ago that Mayor Cranley held a press conference on the west side and he announced that they were going to apply for a grant to make this sidewalk a reality?
Yeah.
And this week, council voted to accept those grant dollars.
Right. So last spring, it was announced that they were going to apply for Safe Routes to School. And then in May, ODOT officially announced that they won that award. And then, as you said, yes, it was on yesterday that city council voted to officially accept that grant. And Madeline tells me that that money is supposed to become available in 2021. So that's kind of the next angle of this story, is that by then she will have graduated from Sans Montessori.
The school she's trying to walk to.
Right. Yeah. So she won't actually be using the sidewalk to get to school once it's built, because she'll be going elsewhere. But her two younger siblings will still be going to Sands, so she remains optimistic about it.
What was her argument? How did she convince them? I mean, you've got some powerful people here that an elementary school student walked in and pretty much got what she wanted. And that's hard to do,
right? And
even for adults.
So I've spoken with a number of people about this story because we've been following it for a couple of years now, and I think what really resonated with me was I was speaking with Mike Morosky, a member of the school board. And he put it this way. He said that leaders, there might be something about a child's request, especially when it's the school children who are the ones walking to and from school, that kind of gives a power to it that adults might not have when they're making this request on behalf of students. There's something to be said for students making or taking the action themselves that gives it kind of an extra push. So I think that's something that was at play here when you had a student who was making this pretty humble request for a sidewalk that will stretch about 500 feet that kind of has this symbolism about a bigger problem that is going on throughout the city.
But even though she ultimately is going to get what she wanted, along the way that she learned that government bureaucracy is not always easy to deal with. First from it wasn't so simple as just to build a sidewalk, and then there was something that the school board had to update.
Right. Yeah. So when I asked her on Wednesday what she's learned the most, it was that it takes too long to do this kind of stuff. And, you know, from
welcome to government.
Right. Exactly. So but yes, to your point, there was more that had to be done than just paving the sidewalk. The Sussex Avenue where this would be installed doesn't have curbs. It doesn't have any drainage infrastructure there. And then the school board, in order to qualify for the Safe Routes to School grant program, they had to update their Safe Routes to School plan. They had to do it first for her school individually, and then now I understand that they're working on that district-wide. So it's definitely had a lot of bureaucratic steps that she had to maneuver.
But I guess, you know, we said that the funds aren't going to be available right away, so it's going to be built, but she may not be able to take advantage of it to walk. But she still feel successful in what she accomplished?
Yeah, she does, and, you know, the fact that she has two younger siblings gives her a sense of satisfaction that she's done this. And you know, she's also a part of the Youth Pedestrian Safety Task Force that was created last year after 2018 saw more than a dozen CPS students hit while they were walking to or from school. So she, along with JT Thornton, who I understand you've also had on the program with Madeline, they co-chair that committee, and I know that they have plans to keep expanding that.
This is all part of a larger effort in the area that focused on Vision Zero to make it safer for pedestrians. That's now a program at the city. There's somebody in charge of it. It looks like initially it's showing some good results, some positive results.
Yes. So WCPO, we reported earlier this month that 2019 – the first year that this Vision Zero vision, for lack of a better word, this plan, and that basically refers to a set of policies and commitments to slowing traffic down, making streets friendlier for people who are not necessarily using cars. 2019, the first year that was in process, was the first year since 2013, the first year we have data for, that pedestrian-involved crashes actually decreased. So city leaders see that as a big deal, but you know, we're still talking about almost one crash involving a pedestrian every day in the city of Cincinnati. So leaders they're not satisfied with that, but they see it as moving in the right direction.
And some of the things that have been – I know there are like things in the roadway to indicate a crosswalk. There are signs that have flashing lights that you're a crosswalk, and I think even some of those that pedestrians themselves can activate when they're getting ready to use the crosswalk.
That's right. Yeah, those are all examples of some of the infrastructure that's been going in. We're seeing a lot more of the paddles in the middle of the crosswalks, and like you mentioned, the pedestrian-activated flashing lights. And we're seeing a lot of these, especially around school zones and where public parks or around churches or community centers, where basically more vulnerable road users would be more likely to be trying to cross the street.
We talked about, you know, what has been done. Is there some big thing that is yet to come, something that's on the dream list of Vision Zero that is just waiting to find the funding or the appetite to implement?
Well, there's always the return back to the Liberty Street Improvement Project, which finally had a compromise made last year, but that project has yet to get started. It'll reduce Liberty Street down to 6 lanes, I believe, with one side widening the sidewalk. But as far as 2020 projects go, last I checked, they're still taking requests from all 52 neighborhoods for what they would like to see. So that's really how the process works, is a community council will go to the city administration and say, these are the top 5 things we'd really like to see done. And then it's up to transportation officials at the city to score those with a rubric they have and then prioritize them. But with 2019, every neighborhood that requested something got something. So that's where the process is now. We're still waiting to see what those improvements will be this year.
WCPO Transportation Reporter Pat LaFleur, thanks for talking with us.
Always. Thank you, Jay.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with an interview recorded earlier. WVXU's Marianne Selesnick talks to senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson about social media and the hearings in the Senate.
Howard, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
We are talking about the impeachment today, and a lot of things have already been said, and we're not going to try to rehash everything that the NPR reporters are doing. But one of the things that might be interesting to take a look at is the role of social media in this whole impeachment process. Tell us a little bit about what you've observed so far.
Well, one of the things was that President Trump, despite denying that he's paying any attention to this, was hammering out tweets at a record pace on Wednesday. While the Democrats were presenting their case to the Senate, 141 tweets went out from and retweets from the president on that one day alone. And this is at a time when he is in Davos, Switzerland, attending a World Economic Conference, but somehow, I don't know how he does it, finds the time to knock out 141 tweets, criticizing the process, criticizing the Democrats, criticizing everything, and retweeting anything that he sees on Twitter that's positive towards him.
How are people paying attention to that? Do you think people follow his feed very closely?
Yeah, a lot of people do, obviously, and they are mostly his followers, the people who voted for him, people who still support him. But also, you know, everybody has to follow this, particularly in the news media, because that's the only way, really, that he communicates with the public and with the rest of the government. I mean, he's told Congress that he's going to inform them via tweet if he decides to go to war with somebody, which is not really what the Constitution requires. But I don't think they ever anticipated the Twitter world. But yeah, people are paying attention to it.
One person that's perhaps paying attention and has decided to tweet out at the president is Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. What happened there?
Rand Paul was tweeting on his own, and he basically said, you know, he was tweeting directly to the president or addressing the president, saying, look, if you want to come and attend this trial, which Rand Paul thinks is a charade and ridiculous, he said, if you want to come and attend, here is a pass to the Senate gallery where you can come and sit and listen to this. He said, I will give it to you. And of course, you know, the White House has had no official response to this, and I doubt seriously if he's going to take him up on that offer. But it got Rand Paul, basically what he wanted was to make the point that he thinks that the president should have the right to be there, not necessarily to question, but to listen. And if, in fact, they do call more witnesses at some point, to be there to confront them.
If they do call witnesses, do you think the president would even consider showing up?
I doubt it, seriously. I mean, I really don't. I mean, if he listens to anybody among his advisors, he will stay away. He has a legal team that's perfectly competent and able to handle this. And if I were in his shoes, I would say, you go ahead and take care of it. You know, Bill Clinton didn't show up at his. And it's just not considered. You hire a legal team to do this for you.
What are you seeing in your own Twitter feed, Facebook feed, social media feeds that you have and how people are reacting to what they've seen so far in this impeachment trial?
Well, I get, you know, tweets from people on both sides, obviously, you know, people who favor a conviction in the Senate, people who are opposed to it, people who are opposed to the impeachment articles themselves. But among the people who want to see him removed from office, it's a funny kind of division. There are some people who are listening to this every word for hours and hours until the wee hours of the morning and listening to the presentations. And there's another group of people who support removing him from office, but they've just kind of thrown their hands up and said, we're not going to listen anymore. We know what the problem is. We know what he did. So they're basically saying, we can't take it anymore. We've had it. We've hit our limit. And so they're not listening.
What about the other side? You hear?
Well, the other side is just basically, I'm not sure if they're listening or not. Some of them are, and they're being very critical of the House managers, you know, for the case that they're presenting. But nobody ever attacks the essence or the points that they're making against President Trump. They start bringing in other things like Hunter Biden and everything else. And what about Hillary Clinton? And what about this? And what about that? But they're paying attention, though.
Well, Howard, I do want to let everybody know that if they'd like to hear more of your insight about the election itself that's coming up here in 2020, not only the presidential election, but there's a lot going on in Ohio in general and in Hamilton County, along with some other counties as well. You have a new newsletter.
I do.
It's called Counterpoints. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Counterpoints is going to come out once a week, and it's going to you need to sign up for it with your email address. It's very simple. You can do it at wvxu.org. You go on the homepage, and you'll see my lovely visage, and you click on that, and you'll find a link that you can sign up with just with your email address. And it will pop up into your inbox every Wednesday morning.
And tell us what kind of things are going to be in that.
It's going to be a lot of different things, and it's going to be things that are kind of off the beaten path that, you know, you may not read in other publications or see on television or even hear on the radio. We're going to look at things that are kind of behind the scenes, what's happening in these races. And sometimes it's going to be funny, and sometimes it's going to be just, you know, outrageous. And I just want it to be a good read for people. Plus, we're going to have links to other stories that I've done and other people here have done about politics so that you can catch up on the past week's political news by just going to the one source and click on those stories.
And this continues through the November election.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be fun.
Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Howard Wilkinson is WVXU's senior political analyst. You can read his columns and his stories and sign up for Counterpoints at WVXU.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our Friday news review. In the studio now are WVXU News reporters Ambrielle Crutchfield and Tana Weingartner. We'll get to Tana, or Tanimal, in a few minutes to talk about a big birthday at the Cincinnati Zoo. But first, Ambrielle, let's discuss some interesting local developments with school vouchers.
Oh, and sure. Do new first. news, whatever.
So we're talking about Ohio's Ed Choice voucher program. So tell us what that is.
Yeah. So basically, the program allows people, the way it is under the current law, is that if you're going to a school that meets a certain criteria, you can use public school district money in order to go to a private school of your choice if the private school lets you in. And state lawmakers made that change in 2019, at the end of 2019. And schools here, Cincinnati Public Schools, Middletown, as well as Sycamore, are not happy about that. And they're really making their voice known. And they're trying to get state lawmakers to change the criteria before the February 1st deadline, which is when families can apply. So to get an understanding, like, one of the criteria is if your school that your student goes to or is in the area to go to received a D or an F in a category on the state report card, or a D or F overall on the 2014 report card, you're eligible to be able to go to a different school with the private school voucher.
So one of the changes that the lawmakers made, they basically expanded sort of that what was considered a failing building. And it doesn't necessarily mean all the buildings are that bad, but they are in that failing category, and it opens up this ed choice option to students and parents.
Yeah, and a lot of schools are not happy about that because there's been a lot of conversation about how the report card just isn't – it doesn't really measure the growth of that these school districts are having and show what's going on in the schools. So them expanding that, they kind of feel like it's already putting – they're expanding something flawed on a flawed foundation, basically.
And we said this applies to buildings, so it's not the school district. It's actually school building, which – school buildings, but there are tens of thousands of those in Ohio. You found out in Middletown it hit them particularly hard.
Yeah, so I really had to like double check to make sure I was getting this right, because Middletown has 10 schools, and all 10 of their schools are listed as you can go to a private school with a voucher, which just is alarming amount. So that was definitely a very interesting thing.
And for Middletown, these vouchers come with money that some of that is state money, but it doesn't necessarily cover the full amount. So this could take money out of the Middletown school budget in a significant amount.
Yeah. So say, for example, for elementary students, it's over $4,000 for them to be able to go, which is something that the school district has to pay for. And for high school students, it's $6,000. So the treasurer at Middletown was saying at that point, we're having to dig into our local levies that our taxpayers voted for to be able to pay for that. And right now, Middletown is in good standing financially, and they're even stacking up money for the future. But this is going to put them in the black, in the red.
And the state money that you were talking about, I think, was what, in the $4,000 range?
Mm-hmm.
So the local money, I think it was $4,400 for elementaries and up to $6,000 for high schools.
Yeah, that's correct.
And that's money that's coming out of the Middletown budget. So what are they asking? What do they want? What are these Middletown school officials asking state lawmakers to do?
Yeah, so last week and this week, they had these community meetings just trying to urge their parents to get an understanding of what is going on with the Ed Voucher program, and also reaching out, making sure that the parents are reaching out in addition to their school officials.
And it sounds like they're having some success, because a story that we had on Friday morning from Andy Chow, who we had on earlier, was saying that the state lawmakers are considering some changes.
Yes, they are. They're considering changing it to where it's only schools that got an F on the report card, which that's a lot of change that they're going to have to make before February 1st, which is fastly approaching.
So, and this has to be done, so they would have to basically act within the next week for this to take effect.
Yeah.
Another story you reported this week was that, talking about schools, that serving healthy food is eating into the Cincinnati public school budget. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically they're participating in this good food purchasing program, which is their commitment to make sure that they're buying from local economies, environmental sustainability farms, as well as farms that care about animal welfare. But since they've been, the more they expanded, the more it's eating into their budget. Right now, they've seen a 30% increase in how much they're spending, which is coming from federal funding.
So what's their plan to try to remedy that?
So they're trying to get students to get more interested in breakfast. And it's kind of funny that this loopholes back into our earlier conversation this school year about transportation, and parents had a lot of concerns on how students were going to have time to eat if their bus was running late. So the official I talked to said that they're always working with the transportation department to make sure that things are going cohesive and students are able to eat breakfast. And they also are putting these little stop-and-go areas where kids can grab breakfast on their way to class.
And breakfast is important because I think your story points out that they actually can make money mm-hmm. on breakfast.
Yeah, because during lunch, they're having to pay more for labor since they're paying their the school workers like $15 and some change, and including benefits. But in the morning, they just don't have that issue since things are a little bit easier to prepare.
All right. And that story is on our website if you want to check that out, wvxu.org. All right. Now we switch to Tanimal Weingartner. I think I'm going to nominate. I don't know that I have this power, but I'm going to name you our senior zoo correspondent.
Okay. Can have senior animal correspondent.
Okay. You can have that put on a business card.
I'll get right on that.
So we've talked about it. Today is a big birthday for someone at the zoo, a hippo that I don't think anyone's heard of before.
Yeah, well, you know, 3 years ago, this little hippo arrived with no, you know, ceremony at all. So today is Fiona's third birthday. Of course, the backstory there is she wasn't really expected to survive. She came too early, and she just captured the hearts and minds of people around the world with her survival story. So yesterday, you know, because it was all rainy and gross today, they weren't sure she'd be able to be out. yesterday she got her birthday cake early. So we asked the zoo. Yeah.
And it's a birthday cake fit for a hippopotamus.
For a queen. Yes. And for a hippopotamus. Yeah. So we asked for the recipe and we have it on our website. But, you know, basically, if you're looking to make a hippo birthday cake, you want to start with bamboo, have some Timothy hay, lots of berries. You want to make your giant three out of beet pulp and a little bit of a juice, squash, all kinds of fruit. They had cut stars and things out of cantaloupe to decorate it. Lots of grapes, kiwi, all of her favorites, basically, served atop a bed of romaine lettuce. They actually did a taste test where they offered Fiona like all kinds of foods and to figure out what her favorite was. And she just loves romaine lettuce. So,
and it looked like when they released her, from what I saw the video, yes. She kind of looked at it and then she just dove right in.
Right. Yeah. Well, she had to size it up. She's like, where should I start with all of my favorites served all at once? And then you're right. She did just kind of jump in and she had a good helping. But then, of course, she is a sharer.
And so Mom Bibi got involved.
Exactly. And they did say, you know, Bibi is on a diet. So this cake was a little lighter than in previous years. And then it was nice. And Bibi went in for a swim and Fiona thought that looked good. So she hopped on in as well.
But this really is an amazing story that's captured the attention of the whole world. I think you talked about she's getting cards from all over the world.
Right. Senior zookeeper, head Africa keeper Wendy Rice said they still get mail like on every holiday for Fiona. People make hand-created letters and cards and send them to her from around the world. People still travel to the zoo from around the world. Just to see this hippo.
And it was very touch and go from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, they involved, I think it was even Children's Hospital
right.
in her care.
Children's Hospital sent two nurses over. They couldn't get an IV, I believe, started in her in order to, you know, help her out when she was, you know, on death's door, if you will. So these two nurses all of a sudden were thrown in the spotlight because they were able to get that line in.
And she's still...
still doing great.
And still gets everyone's attention when she flips her ears.
She still does the ear flip. She still mugs for the camera. She seems to, her keeper say, walk this sort of weird line. She's all hippo, but she's definitely a little media darling.
Just so that Fiona doesn't get all the attention.
Right.
Today, you had other news from the zoo that the female polar bear is not pregnant.
Right. Inanna is not pregnant. She came here 4 years ago to mate with Little One, the zoo's male polar bear, who is considered the most genetically valuable polar bear in North America's captive zoo population because he's never sired offspring. So the problem with captive populations is you have to really manage who they mate with, you know, so that you don't end up with genetic problems. So Little One, who's 30, has never had offspring. They had hoped that this would be the case, but after three fake-out pseudo-pregnancies, three tries, nothing has come of it. So she will go next week to Detroit with the hopes of mating there with their male polar bear named Nuka, who has sired offspring, so, you know, fingers crossed for her.
Perhaps more luck in Detroit.
Yes.
WVXU reporters Ambriel Crutchfield and Tana Tanimal Weingartner, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show was Elise Meckler. The associate producer is Selena Reeder. And our technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Jay Hanselman, filling in for Michael Monks. Have a great weekend.